I am absolutely salty. I mean, that's, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I was raised on salt. I add salt to everything. I'm all about NaCl.
Welcome to episode 41 of There Is No Offseason, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley, and I am joined by BP's Fantasy Manager and Rankings Fetishist, Brett Sayer, and my fellow authors, someone who is a very good planner of internet content, Mauricio Rubio, and the man I will get to hold in a sweet, sweet embrace tomorrow, Craig Goldstein. Good evening, guys. Say hi to everyone and tell them where they can find you on the interwebs. And Brett, let's start with you.
You can find me at baseballperspectus.com and thedynastyguru.com and on Twitter at dynastyguru. Mal?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus, and you can also find me on Twitter at mrubio52. Craig?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus and the Dynasty Guru. You can find me on Twitter at CD Goldstein. That's CD as in Cadillac DeVille Goldstein. Ben?
You can also find me at Baseball Prospectus and at The Dynasty Guru, and you can find me on Twitter at Ben Carsley. You can find this podcast on Twitter via the aptly named at Tino Podcast handle, and you can ask us questions and talk to us about your feelings by emailing us at tinopodcast@gmail.com. So this is a pretty big week for Tino because tomorrow I am getting on a plane, actually in about 10 hours. I'm getting on a plane and flying to see Craig. And this is not a drill. I will be spending the night with Craig, both in a biblical and literal sense. Yeah, I would. Well, that's to be determined.
Is this going to be romantic, or is this just kind of a business trip here?
I don't know.
I like a little tenderness.
Yeah, there'll be a Snapchat story, so don't worry. Get your popcorn ready.
Ooh, baby.
But there's a pretty good chance this is the last Tino. Because I'm not entirely sure Craig and I are going to make it out of this weekend alive, at least not if I have anything to say about it. But the good news is I think this is going to be a pretty entertaining Tino because we get to talk about minor league shortstops. And there are a lot of pretty good minor league shortstops. That's partially because a lot of these guys are going to move eventually, and it's partially just because this is a pretty nice class. So you have that to look forward to shortly. And we're not even going to fake a third topic. We're not going to talk about current events. We're not going to talk about a mock draft. We're just going to roll with it. But first, as we do every once in a while, I think we should start with reader emails. And our first reader email is from Jay Good. Jay Good says, "Dear Tino, I'm going into my third season as owner in a 12-team keeper league. Last year, I knew I needed to improve keepers and hit some proverbial home runs in the draft to have any chance of competing, so I took a pretty high-risk-reward approach. I had as many misses as hits, landing me in sixth place, but I was able to dramatically improve my six keepers. I'm in a good position to try to win it all, so this year I want to draft safe, boring veterans with a high probability of hitting their projections who may come at a discount for being over 30. Do you have any tips on drafting safe in a keeper league? Who are some guys outside the top 75 you like in this scenario? Thanks, Jeff." And then he says, for background, his keepers are Carlos Gomez, Freddie Freeman, Jose Altuve, Josh Donaldson, Madison Bumgarner, and Corey Kluber. So clearly a pretty strong list of keepers, even in a 12-team league. And then some notable names will probably not be kept: Pence, Vimart, Reyes, Ortiz, Holiday, Alexi Ramirez, Lucroy, Arenado, Blackman, Cole Calhoun. So Craig, feel free to take this in any direction. I don't know if you want to talk about sort of this overarching strategy. To me, there are some pretty damn attractive names who will not be kept, but take us off. Well, lead us off. Don't take us off. That's very moral.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's interesting that he's talking about kind of safe guys and stuff like that when you've, I mean, not that they're not safe, but I mean, John Lucroy and Hunter Pence are extremely high quality players. And a little bit further in the email, he talks about going after an elite closer with one of his first two picks. And I mean, I guess I understand that he knows the league better than we do, certainly in terms of what's going on. But it strikes me as a possible mistake to take someone like a Kenley Jansen or a Greg Holland when if you have the opportunity to get Lucroy or Pence or even Nolan Arenado. I mean, this is a 12-team league. It's not like you shouldn't be able to get some closers. In terms of the safe versus risky thing, I mean, I think it's always a mistake to go heavy on like just all risk or all safety, because the thing is exactly what happened to him is what goes on is that you end up you take a ton of high risk, high reward guys. And if half of them pan out, you're nowhere. So you really need a combination of both and to have a relatively high baseline from the safe guys who then are accented by, you know, those high risk, high rewards guys. So, that's my kind of high level take on the whole thing. Brett, do you have another angle?
No, I think that's a really strong point. That's more or less what I was going to say here. I'd be curious as to why some of these guys aren't going to be kept, but I mean that may just be the nature of the league. I mean, that's 72 guys total, right? 12 teams, six keepers. So there's no way that. You know, we talked about this in the past. When you get leagues that are, you know, less than 100 keepers per season overall, you really just don't worry about long term. You get the players you want for 2015, and you worry about the rest later. So, Ben, you have any additional thoughts on this?
Nothing terribly profound. I think just speaking to your point, the fact that it's, you know, a six keeper per team league. I do think this enables you to sort of take risks more than a dynasty league would, because even if, like Craig said, you know, you go 50-50 and you're nowhere, or even if you really, really tank and let's say, you know, 2 out of 12 risky picks pay off, you're only setting yourself back for 1 year. So I would be a little more prone to gamble in a league like this. I don't really know what his keeper list looks like in contrast to others. I mean, if people aren't keeping Lucroy and Pence, I think it's maybe this team is not quite as set as I thought it was upon initial reading. I think I'm just used to operating in deeper leagues. But yeah, I mean, like, don't Craig put it perfectly. Don't go into the draft with the strategy of I'm going to only take risky guys. That being said, push comes to shove, I'm okay with a slightly riskier, or I guess a slightly higher variance draft strategy in this format. Now?
Yeah, the only thing that I'll add, because you guys pretty much summed it up perfectly, is that the flip side of that coin, the flip side of going all risk and instead trying to go for all safety, is that you end up finishing fourth in the league. So, you know, to accentuate the point that Craig made, you really want to have a blend in here, because if you want to win your league, you're going to have to take some gambles. You know, you can draft the all-vanilla team and then finish up as a runner-up because somebody decided to take a gamble on a couple of guys, you know, like Corey Kluber last year, and having it work out pretty well.
All right, I'm pretty satisfied with that round table. We will briskly move on to our second reader email of the week then, and this one is from friend of the podcast, Dave. And friend of the podcast, Dave, says, "Hello, gentlemen of Tino. Since your next topic is shortstops based on recent trends, I thought I would ask a question about shortstops because I'm a strong contributor to this podcast. With the shortstop position being terrible after a certain tier, what is your drafting strategy? Do you target the better shortstop players earlier than normal so you don't get stuck with assholes like Danny Santana? Do you not overpay for a top-tier shortstop because you're happy with Danny Santana? Or would you just draft who you get and then make a trade to upgrade Danny Santana? In summation, boo Danny Santana. This topic can also translate to second base and catcher because they are terrible too, and so is fantasy baseball. Thank you, as always, friend of the podcast, Dave." Very strong last point. Fantasy baseball is terrible and dumb, and I don't know why we do this to ourselves. But Mal, I will kick you off here. I mean, I basically take this question as, how do you treat shallow positions overall? So give us your spiel.
Just generally, I don't worry about how deep or shallow a position is, you know, until the later rounds. And it depends a lot on league depth, right? So if you're in a 20-team league and it's going to be about the third or fourth round and you're seeing some of those shortstops starting to dry up, that's kind of when I start thinking about it. It doesn't become an urgent thing. It's not like an urgent matter, but it's in the back of my mind. And I start thinking about seeing where the runs are happening and kind of where I am in the draft. But in shallower leagues, like in 12 to 14, it's, you know, I'm taking best player available for quite a while. And the bottoms of the shortstop tiers, specifically in redraft leagues, they're not great. But you can still get some value down there, maybe even take a couple of flyers. And if worse comes to worse, that's something that you have to address in season. But, you know, in dynasty leagues specifically, I think... while it's not a glamour position, or it's not, I mean to reword that. While it's not a particularly deep position at the major league level, I think there's certainly enough talent at the minor league level to kind of augment the bottom half of that list. Where I just it's something that I think about after a certain point, but it's not something that I try to address with say like a first or a third round pick. But that's just me. Why don't we talk to the master here and kick this out to Brett? Brett?
Well, and Brett, I was on mute. I started talking. I blame Danny Santana. So the first like six words of that were really good, and I forgot what they were. But it's really a balancing act you have to have between spending to make sure that you don't get stuck with guys that suck at these shallow positions and not going too far out of your way to fill them. And, you know, you see it with, you see it more in the mid range than you do at the high end. I mean, at the high end of these positions, you're talking about guys, you know, at catcher, you're talking about Buster Posey and Jonathan Lucroy. At shortstop, you're talking about Troy Tulowitzki and Ian Desmond. You know, at second base, you got, you know, Rendon, Cano, Altuve. You got guys that are going to put up stats regardless of their position. So, I mean, you tick them up slightly because they're at the shallow positions, but they're going to hit everywhere. Where you really want to be careful is to not tick up the guys in the middle who could be decent options, but also could kind of suck. And obviously it depends on the depth of your league anyway, because if you're in a 12-team league and you take a chance at one of these positions, there's going to be guys available. There's going to be guys that you don't absolutely hate at these positions. But if you play in a 16-team league, then if you lose your, you know, shortstop, you may end up playing, Escobar or Brandon Crawford, and that's not particularly attractive if you're in a mixed league. So it's something you want to be cognizant of, but not something you want to drench yourself in. Craig?
Yeah, I'll try not to go on too long because I think you guys covered it. I think league size is hugely important because mid-tier players in kind of 18 and team and deeper leagues get real thin, and just having guys who you don't have to worry about is a big deal. So guys like, you know, Eric Ibar or Ben Zobrist, guys that are kind of in the three-star tier of Mike Gianella's rankings that were up on BP this week, those guys are really important in deeper leagues. In shallower leagues, I'm all for either the top-tier guy or waiting on a Danny Santana or whoever is down at the bottom, because Ben Zobrist is who I submitted my article on who to avoid, and he's a really nice player, but right now he's a 10 home run, 10 steal, 270s average guy, and that's not really special. And so I'd rather take a risk on either getting someone who's really good in one category, be it stolen bases or batting average, and it's empty everywhere else, or, you know, whatever it may be, and maybe address the position in mid-season in terms of getting categories, then just taking going for a safe guy earlier than I'm comfortable with just because he's reliable. And the only other thing I would say is in terms of drafting, is it's harder in an auction, but in a snake draft, with positions like these that are, you know, a couple top guys and then a lot of just kind of middling depth, I want to be either the guy picking up people at the end or starting a run. And I think that can be a really valuable thing. If you're the guy who gets, you know, if someone's taken Troy Tulowitzki, I kind of want to be the guy taking Ian Desmond or waiting a really long time, if that makes sense. Ben, do you have anything to add?
I think this is usually the part where I would say, no, I don't have much to add, and then basically rephrase you. So I'll just say, no, I don't have anything to add. All right. Well, that's good. That's a nice silence following. That's what I'm looking for. Thank you for the help.
Oh, I did want to say one more thing. Sorry.
Oh, well, now's a good time to say it, and not when I was, drowning in silence.
I meant to start off my comment with this.
This is so us. That
not since Ryan Flaherty has one shitty baseball player been so disparaged on our podcast. You guys don't even remember the Ryan Flaherty days?
Yeah, no, I remember that.
I remember that.
You guys, fine. I thought it was a good callback. But
it was a decent callback, but I felt it like was, the pause was strong. Yeah, the pause was a little pregnant, I think.
Oh, well, fine.
That's fair. It's tough, but fair. Yeah. All right. I'm really looking forward to this next reader email because...
Very quickly, Ben, was this sent at 3:40 in the morning? Do you know?
Was what? Oh, was it?
No, it was not.
No, but the comment. God, that was glorious.
I'm out of the loop.
That was one of my favorite G-chats Mal has ever sent. Someone left a comment about where Yoan Moncada would rank in... I don't even know what article it was, but they posted it at 3:40 in the morning.
To be fair, in West Coast time, that's only pathetic instead of heart-crushingly sad. all right. So you kind of gave it away there, but I'm excited for this next question because it's very unique. But we've made fun of it so often that it's probably time we actually answered it. So... this question comes from Tim and was appropriately sent at 4:20 in the afternoon. Oh, 4:20, nice. Tino guys, what would you be willing to spend in Moncada in a first-year Dynasty League where he is included in the auction? $100 budget, normal offensive categories, plus OPS, 28-team league. Why? Also, Gmail autocorrects Tino to Tiny. Would you find being addressed as Tiny Guys offensive? Thanks for the help, Tim. Brett, Moncada has come up once or twice. Feel free to answer either in the confines of this 28-team weird fucking format of the week or just sort of, you know, where you see him overall in terms of new signees and prospects.
Okay, so I get a little confused by this just because I don't know whether he's available in fab bidding or did you guys get that sense as well?
I was also confused.
Actually a question I had. I couldn't tell.
Yeah, I was also confused because he was asking what you would spend in Moncada. So I'm assuming Moncada is now a currency, and I wasn't aware of it.
It should be a currency if it's not a currency.
Or a
sandwich.
Yeah, or a sandwich. It's a strong point.
Yeah. So I am going to answer the question as though it is a fab bid, and I'm going to say... where is he included in the auction? $100, but yeah, this question is not worded well, but I'll answer it both ways. If he's a fab bid, I would spend all $100 on him, and just say fuck it to the rest of the year. If it really is a first year dynasty league where you get $100 to spend on everybody, I would say. I mean, it also depends whether salaries increase $3, $4, maybe $5, depending on depth. But you can't you in a 28-team league, you gotta actually spend on guys that will play. So there's not enough information here. But Makata, taking a step back from this actual question, Makata is going to be really, really good based on what we have been hearing. What I've been hearing, the scouting reports. The scouting reports are disgusting. He's 19. He's coming over from Cuba. Who knows when he's going to be in the majors or what team he's going to sign with. But he's someone to get excited about. I think he's a slam dunk top 20 fantasy prospect once he signs. And he could be closer to the front end of that, that was an awkward way of phrasing it. He could be in the 10 to 15 range, depending on where he signs and where he starts his minor league career. So he's got power, he's got speed, he can hit. It's fun, but let's also not anoint him the greatest player ever in the history of the world yet. There will be time for that if he deserves it, but not yet. Craig.
Yeah, I don't know that I have much to add. Everything that I've been very reserved on Moncada for the most part because we just didn't know that much about him. But now that he's kind of doing individual workouts for teams, there's a lot more kind of stuff leaking out. And everything that I've heard has been just beyond glowing. I've heard he was far and away would be the 1-1 pick in the upcoming draft, like significantly over Brendan Rodgers, who's kind of the front runner in that area right now, even though it's early. So I've heard a ton of really good stuff, and I think, you know, what Brett said in terms of where he'd rank makes a lot of sense, and I agree with the strategy on kind of both whether it's Fab or if he's being included in the auction. So I'll toss it out to Mal, but that I think Brett kind of nailed it.
Yeah, you guys both nailed it, and I think something that we should maybe pocket when it comes closer to draft time is both the Moncada discussion in regards to where he would be drafted and also just what that says about where the draft is overall. Because, you know, I'm sure you guys have heard the same thing. I've heard that, you know, if Rodgers is the 1-1 pick, that while he is an extremely gifted player and a very good player, that probably in other years he wouldn't be the 1-1. So, you know, I think that's something that we could probably save for later. And, you know, I'll give this back to Ben.
I'm pleased. I'm pleased with the way everyone summed that up. I'm pleased that for once this is the appropriate week in which to be asking Moncada questions. And I really hope he signs soon so that we can then give a definitive say on where he ranks from a dynasty point of view, because we'll know his organization. And then we can just stop talking about him for a little while, because he's very exciting, but my enthusiasm for him is being destroyed by the onslaught of tweets and bat signal questions and comments. He's good.
Yeah, and just to throw this out, I mean, it's easy to say. I mean, I know people throw it out and it sounds impressive. It's easy for people to say that he'd be the 1-1 pick in this draft, but, you know, I love Brendan Rodgers, but Rodgers is 17 years old and has some exciting raw tools. I mean, Moncada is 19 and has professional league experience in another country. So you're not exactly comparing apples to apples. He's not a 17-year-old kid from Cuba, but he's good. So just don't besmirch Brendan Rodgers, because I love Brendan Rodgers.
I think we're all on the Brendan Rodgers train, right?
Yes.
Can't wait for those questions to start rolling in. Excellent.
I mean, I don't know. It's way too early for me. I think I would be my top guy right now for the draft is Matuella.
Mine as well. I was actually, just talking about that. Mine as well.
He's real good. He's real good.
I don't know yet.
But it's so early in the process.
Yeah, it is.
Well, one thing's for sure. None of these guys are quite as good as Forrest Wall.
Shots fired.
If only,
I just took Wall in a draft today.
First round?
Second.
Okay, strong.
Second round of a 20-team draft.
Impressive.
So and I'm in the middle, so it's like pick 30, I think.
Overall, right? Start from scratch?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, cool. All right, I will move us on to our final reader email of the week, which is from Meepits, who's probably borderline friend of the podcast at this point. I think he's got one or two emails to go. Meepits says, listeners' emails still often start with a canned put-down of Craig. Craig probably has crabby days like anyone, probably. But in general, he's no saltier on Tino or Twitter than Ben, Mike Gianella, or the average Twitter user for that matter. People contrived this craze thing well before his sassy outburst in the mid-season Brett 500 episode of Tino, and even then, he wasn't alone in taking a tone with Brett. Listeners keep the joke alive to affect familiarity with you, to seek external validation by crapping on someone they don't really know, or to appear clued in, not because Craig is really some super edgy antagonist all the time. Segway. This bothers me about as much as when an analyst calls a healthy player, who has been generally healthy for a few years, an injury risk because of some injury well in the past. Mike Gianella, actually salty, pointed out this fallacy that if a guy's been injured in the past, he'll always be injured. I think he was talking about Ian Kinsler on Flags Fly Forever. Obviously, we know the risk with Tulo/cargo types, but who are some players whose stock is artificially deflated by overblown, outdated health concerns? Cheers, Meepits. I think this is a great. Let's address the first part of the question because I can't let that go. You know, we know how we talk about players who go through cycles of being really overrated and underrated. This is overcompensating for people picking on Craig. Craig is miserable. He's not nice. Very salty IRL. Not like this figure deserving of pity. Just not a good look to say that about Craig. So yes, perhaps all of the crapping on Craig is overblown, but this goes too far in the other direction. In terms of the actual question, for me, a guy who sticks out, partially because I just wrote about him and I don't think I even fully realized this, is Jose Reyes, who actually, I mean, he has only one season since 2009 in which he has accumulated fewer than 586 plate appearances. So I think we tend to think of Reyes as a guy who is always on the DL, and I do think that it's true that he often plays at less than 100%, but that's not the same thing as not playing. And while 2013 is fairly fresh in our minds, and he only played 93 games that year, you know, since 2009, in which he only played 36 games, played 133 in 2010, 126 in 2011, 160 in 2012. Yes, he only played 93 in 2013, but then he played 143 in 2014. So again, I get that there is some legitimate concern, but he's not a Tulo level guy to me. He's not someone who I am automatically willing to assume is going to miss, you know, 200 plate appearances. He's still pretty reliable, or at least more so than he is referred to as being. So, Mao, I will kick this out to you next. Do you have a thought on Craig, and do you have a player in mind?
I Jose Reyes was also the guy for me. I would tepidly throw in Russell Martin in there as well, although I think, you know, back injuries for catchers are probably appropriately exaggerated. But still, that's, you know, I think that his stock takes a considerable hit because he's been hurt, and he has been hurt in you know, a little bit further back in his history. But my thoughts on Craig. Craig is a little bit difficult for me to pin. I mean, earlier today he was, you know, giving me some very honest and earnest, platitudes and some really good comments about my work. But this is also a man who waged basically a year-long fight about what a sandwich is. And it's a fight that continues to this day. And
don't past tense
that. Yeah,
Yeah. It's ongoing. It's current. It's ardent. And anybody who has that strong of a feeling on sandwiches is just a salty person in general. I mean, I love you, Craig, but that's a hell of a hill, man. That is a hell of a hill.
Brett, any hot Craig or hot injury takes?
I got two things I want to bring up. One, I take a little exception to Cargo being lumped into the Troy Tulowitzki grouping. I think it's a different situation. I mean, Carlos Gonzalez is never a guy that's going to play in 155 games. In fact, he's never played in 145 games, more than 145 games ever. But over the last, I mean, yes, he missed, I believe, 40 games last year for the growth in his finger, which if you think that's going to happen again, then I have a car to sell you. But if you add those games back magically, he has essentially averaged 125 games over the past five seasons. And in that time, he's been an extraordinary fantasy producer. I don't see Cargo as a guy who is particularly more likely than, you know, 15, 20 other guys to play fewer than 120, 130 games this coming season. And I think he's a guy who I think is undervalued because of recency bias in his injury history. The other guy who I want to throw out, and I'm very guilty of this myself, and I have to sort of fight against it a little bit, it sort of comes from the nature of relievers and what we think their shelf life is. But Houston Street has stayed more healthy than I assume that he has often when talking about him. I mean, he's not an 80 inning reliever. That's just not the guy he is. But he's had at least 29 saves in three of the last 4 years, and the 1 year that he did miss, he did have two sort of extended DL stints. He still had 23 saves and pitched in 40 games. He's someone who you will not expect to throw 70 innings, but he's a pretty safe bet for 50 to 60 innings most years, and he's pretty good when he pitches. So that's the guy who I'd throw out, Craig.
Yeah, I've talked about him before, and I know Brett loves him, so I know I'm not going out on a limb here. The guy to me is Aramis Ramirez. I think there are obviously he had a stretch of seasons where he wasn't particularly healthy, and I think he's a good bet to go on the DL, but I also don't think he's necessarily a good bet to miss a ton of time. Three out of the last 4 years he's played in 133 games. Two of those years he played in 149. He's just, I know he's like a little old and creaky, but he hits, and he also really plays in a decent amount of games. And I think he gets docked both for his age and injury history, but he's someone who I think kind of gets docked a little unfairly on the injury history part. I think that stat in terms of how many games he's played over the three out of the last 4 years is fairly surprising to some. I think the other type that you're looking at, and this is more of an archetype than this particular player, is Justin Masterson, for example, this year. Now, he had a knee injury last year. He only threw 129 innings or so. But the 3 years before that, he threw 193, 206, and 216. And again, it's something that there's caution. Having caution is totally reasonable, but going overboard in terms of devaluing him because of the knee injury and the performance caused by the knee injury is a little bit risky to me. And I think you could be costing yourself an interesting player because he has been pretty successful when he's healthy. And I think the key thing is to just keep tabs on what not only what the team is saying about him, which is likely to be positive, and I think he threw a bullpen with no issues recently, but to, you know, make sure you're reading what beat reporters are saying and kind of how people are wording what they're saying about him and gauge your confidence level on that. Because, again, when you're talking about pitchers who are coming off an injury, if that injury is still present, if it is persisting, then it's obviously something you want to avoid. On the other hand, if it's something that was fixed and is fine, you can recoup a huge amount of value. So that's my injury take. The other thing I'll say about me is that I appreciate this email. I like my boy Meepets, so I'm a fan of this email. But I would also say that part of the reason people seek to affect familiarity with me is because I bring it on myself, and so I am absolutely salty. I mean, that's, you know.
Oh yeah.
I was raised on salt. I add salt to everything. I'm all about NaCl. So I appreciate this email, but I also, and while I do get frustrated at times with the kind of, you know, sometimes the way people go about doing it, I totally understand that it happens because I appreciate some self-deprecation and I appreciate playing a character that can be a little overboard. Or a lot overboard. And so, you know, it's just one of those things that happens. Like, it kind of comes with the territory, I think.
Do you know that you're not playing a character anymore?
I'm not convinced of that, actually. I feel like this is not... I'm going to be a star, then.
Mm-hmm. You know, Enya used to think that way as well.
And now she's... Yeah.
Welcome back to episode 41 of Tino. I hope you used that break to clear your schedule for all upcoming episodes of The Slap, which is not a reference you'll understand yet, but you will understand it if you stay till the end of the podcast and listen to There Is No Ending. But let's move us along to our Dynasty League shortstop rankings, created by one Brett Sayer. This is part of our larger positional ranking series going on at Baseball Prospectus right now, in which we really try to attack every position from every angle possible. We have rankings just for 2015, three-year rankings. We have get-to-know series that really speak to up-and-coming players and prospects, AL and NL-only rankings, tail of the tape, adjustments for OBP leagues, anything you could want, we have it. But on this podcast, we focus on Dynasty League fantasy formats, and so we will discuss the Dynasty shortstop list. Brett, Keys, take.
Thank you, Ben. So before we get into the list, I'm going to do something that I haven't done yet on the podcast, and I am going to crush someone's dreams in the comments live on the podcast. There was a comment There was a comment left on my top 50 a couple of hours ago by an unnamed commenter that just says, "Does Christian Arroyo just not have enough upside?" My response: nope. Submit.
But I don't know what else. What was he expecting? Is that Christian Arroyo? Like, who the fuck is asking about Christian Arroyo?
I think it is Christian Arroyo. And it's there. This is so exciting.
Yeah, this is very good. Very good live radio.
At this point, he's not even the best baseballing Arroyo.
Well, I'll debate him.
I don't think it's debatable.
Well, it depends. Mid rehab or post rehab?
That's incredibly.
I'm tapping out.
That's incredibly mean.
So let's talk about the top 50 Dynasty League shortstops. Start in the top. Does the health history of Troy Tulowitzki scare anyone into not having him as their number one guy on this list?
Nope.
There's not really anyone else that can. It's less because of like any confidence in him than it is like the gap between him and everyone else.
That's fair. I have the same answer. So let's talk about the guy who came in at number two on the list. It's not Xander Bogaerts. He came in at three, but number two is Ian Desmond, who is has sort of been the unsuspecting power speed threat who's just stayed for three seasons now. He has three consecutive seasons of going 20-20 at the shortstop position. His batting average dropped in 2014 as his strikeout rate spiked. What sort of confidence level do you guys have in Desmond going forward? Start with Ben.
I agree with this ranking. I know he took a step back in average last year, but he's 29 and the peripheral stats didn't really support such a stark drop in average. So I think he'll rebound modestly there, and he's pretty much a lock for 2020. And like I said, he's only 29. So even though I am the world's biggest Xander Bogaerts fan, I think this is where Desmond belongs, because that type of, I mean, he's both safe and he has upside. That's pretty rare, especially from a shortstop. So I think this is the right decision.
All right. Anyone disagree with Ben?
I've kind of been anti Ian Desmond in the past, and I copped to that kind of, or I kind of backed away from that before this season. I don't think he's necessarily I think maybe what we saw of him in 2014 is more like what we'll see of him going forward than kind of a return to the 280 or 290 batting average he put up before. But the power is real. He can obviously run. So, I it's not an argument with the ranking, but in terms of confidence, I'm more confident in what he was last year than what he was kind of the 2 years prior.
And I guess I split the difference in between the two opinions here, in that I kind of think that he's probably a 270 hitter, but when you start adding in the home runs and the stolen bases, that's in the modern era, that's extraordinarily valuable at shortstop. So, it's fine. I mean, I still heart Xander, but you know, Desmond belongs at number two.
Okay, so we not kind of skipping a little bit out of order. The I dubbed this group in the piece the tier of dreams, as I have Carlos Correa, Addison Russell, Javier Baez, and Corey Seager all in one tier, which is a whole lot of upside all together in a row. So assuming people haven't passed out just by reading those names all together, the four guys that are ahead of that group of prospects, is there an argument to be made to move any of them either below the entire group or below the front names in that tier? Craig.
No, I don't think so. It's kind of tempting to say so, but I don't know that I would trade if I was interested in contending. Not even sure that I was. I don't think I would trade any of the four guys above them for one of the four guys behind. Obviously, if your contention window's a little further back, you don't mind moving a Reyes or even a Starlin Castro, who's obviously still young, for someone with an upside like Seager, Correa, or someone like that. But I really don't think there's a convincing case if you have any notion of contention.
Yeah, the only convincing case that you can maybe make, it involves a long view anyway. So for the purposes of this ranking, it's just I can't really see it either. The guy that I really want to pump up is Seager, but I can't really put him over Hanley Ramirez at this point.
Agreed. I think if anything, maybe you could argue for bringing Xander closer to their level, but I wouldn't move anyone up to where Xander is now. And for the record, I think where you have Xander is perfect, so I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying if you wanted to argue anything, I think it would be Xander down, not any of these Xander-esque guys up.
Yeah, it's often hard to remember anyone not named Ben talking about Bogarts on this podcast, but I think we are unanimously a pro Xander podcast. I still think he's going to have a special bat for the position, and it's going to start, you know, at some point in the next couple of seasons, and he'll be pretty good until that happens. Do you guys want to touch on any of the prospects in that tier? Anyone who you guys feel really strongly about either should be higher or lower within that group? Matt, you talked about Seager. Would you move him above any of the prospects ahead of him?
Yeah, I would put him over Russell, and I would be tempted to put him over Correa as well. I think that's a guy who's he's got the appropriate ceiling, and there's a pretty good base for him to work with. He's eventually going to outgrow Short, right? But everything that I've seen read from him gives me pretty good confidence that he's going to start his career at the major league level at shortstop. So, I'm a little outside with that, but I guess my ranking would definitely be Correa, Seager, Russell, and then Baez, just because I like what Seager brings to the table. So that's kind of how I would go with that.
All right. And anyone else with an opinion?
I would agree. I kind of raised an eyebrow at the gap between Correa and Seager because I kind of see them extremely close as prospects. At the same time, like, they're separated by three spots, and the two people in between are Russell and Baez. So it's not exactly a big difference in terms of talent level. I understand the concerns about him staying at shortstop. I think those concerns can be applied to Correa as well. So I guess I'm a little interested in hearing. I assume I know the answer, but I'm interested in hearing kind of why Correa is certainly above Seager. I don't think it's necessarily likely that either of them stay at the position long term. And Seager doesn't have the injury, and it was a severe ankle injury. Now, it's not to say he can't come back, but it could affect things down the line that Correa has. And, we're talking about guys with plus hit and plus power tools playing the left side of the infield. So in my head, I group them together, and I don't have a problem with Correa being in front, but I don't think it's so drastic that I would necessarily slot Russell and Baez in between. But at the same time, I recognize that's not a big gap.
Yeah, just to clarify that, the difference between Correa and Seager has absolutely nothing to do with eligibility or position. I think Correa has a little bit more in the bat, both in the hit and the power departments. I really, really like Correa's bat. And honestly, they really are not far apart. I mean, in the Dynasty 101 is going to come out at some point, but they're both easy top 10 prospects there. Correa is number 3, and Seager is number 7. So they're separated by very, very few players. And I'm high on Seager as well. I just think, yeah, having Russell and Baez between them is not a knock on Seager. It's just a point in the win column of the depth at shortstop at that point.
Sure.
So we're going now into the sort of the less exciting tier. Although there's still plenty of exciting names in here. It's a healthy mix of prospects who either don't have the upside of the ones that we've mentioned already, don't have the floor of the ones that we mentioned already, or a bunch of veterans who you're happy to have now, but you may not be happy to have in 2 or 3 years. So looking at both of these next tiers as one large group, who is someone you guys would be wary about investing in? Just now, in terms of their perceived value, Ben?
It's strange for me to say this because I like this player in the abstract, but Chris Owings at 15 seems high to me. I don't really know if it is. I'm looking at the names behind him, and I can't really justify moving a ton above him, but I guess it's sort of a stark realization that as exciting as a lot of the names 1 through 10 are, this list really does start to get a little bleak. I like Owings. I think he's going to be a top 10 to 12 guy for a long time, but I do think that's, you know, likely to come closer to the 2016-2017 side than this year, and I just get a little nervous seeing him that high up, but I suppose that's a function really more of the position than of Owings himself. I don't know. The approach still scares me a bit with him, but I think we're relatively all high on Owings, so I'm a bit surprised to hear myself say that. Craig, I think have always valued Owings fairly similarly, so how do you respond to that?
I'm pretty comfortable with it. I think in general, I'd probably have Jimmy Rollins a little higher. I guess the concern might be how long he plays. Obviously, at 36, I think he's going to have a really strong fantasy year, hitting atop the Dodgers lineup. And I think he could do really well in runs. And he's fantasy gold in everything but batting average. And I guess I would probably be a little higher on him. So that would bump Owings back a little, but I'm comfortable with Owings kind of in the area he is, because, you know, I'm looking at the tier below and I'm not sure who I would put over him. Maybe JP Crawford, but I don't think they're necessarily that different in terms of styles of player. And well, I think Crawford could be better. In fantasy, he is a little bit further off, so I understand the placement in that sense. Then you get into the Elvis Andrews, Elcides Escobar type, who are average and speed. And, well, Owings is that as well. I think he's got a little bit more power in his bat. And so, I guess I kind of think of him kind of on par over the course of full season as kind of like Eric Ibar, who's down at 20. And if you want to give him the five spot bump because we're looking at Owings' whole career in front of him and Ibar's kind of 31, then it makes sense to me in that sense. So
yeah, I mean, you know, I agree with all that. I guess getting back to Brett's question, there really isn't anybody else on that list that I think is, you know, overranked or anything, but somebody that I think I would be pretty unhappy with coming away with from both of these tiers is Ben Zobrist, for a lot of the reasons that we touched on a little bit earlier in the podcast. I think he's, you know, he's still a good player, but fantasy-wise, he's just a little bit lacking, especially if you're not in an OBP league and you're in an average league or a standard league. So, yeah, I think Zobrist is the guy that I'm probably the least happy with.
All right. So then the opposite question now for the next grouping. We start once you get down past the Johnny Peralta, Ben Zobrist, JJ Hardy group, you start getting into some players with some upside. So who are some guys after that from about the 24th spot on who you think could return some excess value in 2014, whether it's on the field or whether it's in growth of prospect stock. Matt, I'll start with you this time.
Well, this is a guy that I'm probably going to be higher on than most other people, just because it's the nature of kind of the player. But I think Daniel Robertson is a guy who can experience a lot of growth, just in terms of prospect value and what he can provide to you for your team. I'm pretty aggressive on his ability to hit. I think he has excellent zone command, and he's, you know, really short and quick to the ball. He's got more of a line drive stroke, so it's going to be more gap power than anything. It probably plays up to a fringy level. You're probably looking at 10 to 15 home runs from him, and, you know, anywhere from the 270 to 280 range, and maybe a little bit more depending on the year. But that's, you know, the big question with him is whether or not he can stay at shortstop because of the lack of, you know, the foot speed and, you know, the footwork isn't all that tremendous, but That's a guy that I still believe in. I think he can. He's a hitter. I think he's got a lot of value that he can start accruing, especially if you jump on him now. So, that's a guy that I think is probably going to be a riser, and I think he's a pretty good bet in my mind to start rising up the ranks.
Craig?
I mean, I think when you look at a guy like Barreto, he's already kind of experiencing that surge based on, him being kind of, in quotes, the key to the Josh Donaldson trade, even though, I mean, obviously Brett Laurie and Sean Nolan play a huge part in that as well. The names that I'm looking at in terms of huge jumps are kind of clustered together from 44 to 47. You're looking at Ahmed Rosario, Jorge Mateo, and Ozzino Albies. I think Keith Law said it really well when he talked about Albies in terms of him being like a really polished guy, but someone who is going to hit their kind of peak in terms of being a prospect earlier than some of these other guys. Rosario and Mateo have been successful for their age and their level, even though they've been very low level. This just like Albies has, but they have kind of bigger tools that are going to develop over time longer, so they can kind of have a slower ascent in the eyes of prospect makers and have a higher ceiling to reach. In Ozzino's case, I think he's going to be a really polished guy who's going to succeed at a really young age, but that the ceiling is just not as big, especially his fantasy ceiling. And so I think that he's someone who if he has a successful debut in, like, if they push him to full season ball, if they push him to low A and he holds his own, people are going to be really excited about him as a prospect. And he's already somewhat limited without having much power because he's a really slight guy. I think he's 5'9", 150, or that's his listed weight and height. Because of he lacks a power dimension entirely, he's already devalued in fantasy. And I think the gap between his prospect value and his fantasy value is going to grow over the next year or so. And in that sense, he'll still get a lot of love for being what he is, which is a very good prospect. But that I would just warn people to be aware that there's a cap on that a little lower down than there is on guys like Rosario or Mateo, in my opinion anyway. Ben?
So I will take the opposite tact here. You just talked about a lot of guys who I think could see precipitous gain in Dynasty League value. I'll instead talk about someone who I think could see a modest jump, but provide that soon. And that's Wilmer Flores, who I think I have remained higher on than most over the years. He looks to see a lot of playing time next year. And he's been around for so often that people are tired of him, but he's 23. And he has destroyed AAA in over 400 plate appearances there. I know that, Las Vegas is a very favorable environment for hitters, but still, I mean, he's put up very, very good numbers there, and I don't think he is a future star, but I do think he is a future fairly consistent top 15 fantasy shortstop, and I think he could approach that upside as soon as this year. So, no, I don't think he's the sexiest name. No, I don't think he's a particularly good bet to still be shortstop eligible in, say, 2018. But, in terms of someone who ranks in this tier, who I think could be 7 spots higher next year, 8 spots higher next year, and produce immediate value, I'm comfortable mentioning Flores.
Then, really quickly, because I kind of forgot that the end of this list exists, but two other guys that I think can jump pretty aggressively are two guys that ended up on your just missed area, and that's Gleyber Torres and Wilmer Difo. Difo really had a really solid season at low A. A little bit old for the level, but he's a solid prospect, and he really solidified himself pretty well. Fast guy, okay hit, not much power, but that's a guy that I think can probably see his stock increase with a strong showing in 2015. Torres is that's he's got a little bit of the smoother swing, but he's a little bit more of a complete player. Not a ton of power, but pretty good stroke. I think he's got a pretty even swing as well. You know, short direct path to the ball again. And I mean, those two are guys that I think, you know, I think those guys would be risers too. You know, especially Torres. If he puts it together, he's a pretty decent bet to stick it short. It's just, that's gonna be fun if that turns out.
Yeah, you guys hit all on a lot of really good names here. I mean, Flores is a guy that I'm with you. I think that from a fantasy perspective, he is a strong add at this point. You know, we know he can't really play defense at the position, but we don't really care. Even if he plays there for, you know, 2 months and is terrible defensively and gets replaced, he's still likely to hit enough to play somewhere. And he's going to carry that eligibility at least one more season. So the guy who I want to talk about real quick, and not someone who I think whose stock is going to jump a lot by this time next year, but someone who I think you can arbitrage a little bit now is Jung Ho Kang. There's a lot of talk about Kang, especially as some of the projection systems come out. That make him look pretty positive. I'm not that bullish on Kang long term, although I do think he has a pretty good swing, and I do think he could be a reasonable you know, sort of deeper league option. He's really to be honest, he's really not all that different from the guy who's competing with in Jordy Mercer. He might be that sort of, you know, 260-ish, 15 home run-ish guy. But the combination of the hype that he's likely to get heading into the season and what could be some strong early on performance, I think he's one of those guys that could that could hit pretty well out of the gate until pitchers figure him out. I mean, obviously, pitchers in the KBO didn't figure him out, but pitchers in the KBO, I imagine a whole lot of them self-immolated after the season, based on how juiced that ball was. But it's someone who I think is going to have more value in June than he has now, and then would probably be a wise guy to sell in June if that happens. But as far as a guy whose long term value I think could tick up, I'm gonna mention Didi Gregorius here. I don't think he's a great hitter. He's in a good situation, though, where he's literally the only person in the organization that can play shortstop at the major league level. And it's a left-hander at Yankee Stadium, and he's got enough pop to get to double digits there. And if he can steal a couple bases and hit for a half-decent average, it should be a decent enough lineup. So having him down at 34 here, I think he could be pretty solidly in the 20s after the season. He's never going to be a guy that you want at shortstop in a shallow mixed league or even really a medium sized mixed league, but he'll be usable in a lot of formats, at least more so than I think people give him credit for. So that kind of brings us to the end of the moving up and down this list. Is there anyone else on the list that you guys want to touch on before we move on?
No, I'm not following that up. Shit.
Yeah, Mike was dropped.
Yeah. That's...
All right.
Where would Yoan Moncada rank?
He would be number 1, 5, 26, and 8.
But why not number 3?
That's fair, actually.
Why not number 3, though?
Can't be number 3. Xander's number 3.
Oh, you're biased. Biased.
Ooh. All right, we don't have current events this week, which is quite frankly a relief. So just real quick, I want to talk about my book that was just published, the 2015 Baseball Prospectus Annual, also called BP 2015. It's a book that I wrote mostly by myself with words, and I think it's pretty good, but some of my friends helped me out as well. So I just want to have the gentleman of Tino give a a brief explanation of what their contributions were to my book, and then maybe tell us what your favorite player comment that you wrote was. Craig, let's start with you.
So I wrote most of the minor league aspects for the Orioles and Diamondbacks chapters. So I'm kind of sprinkled throughout those two, mostly on minor league stuff, though I did a few major leaguers for Arizona, including Didi Gregorius, who I got complimented on that comment today, who's over with the Yankees already, but he was with the Diamondbacks at the time we were writing comments. So that ended up over there. And then I also contributed and wrote some blurbs for the top 101 prospects. And I think most of my favorite material is what I did in that section. I was really happy with my Franklin Barreto comment. That's probably my favorite one. But I also really like my Julio Urias comment because I got to mention Desperado, the masterpiece. That is Desperado, I should say. So, Mal?
Well, since we're naming three of our favorite comments like dicks, I guess... I guess my favorite one to write that was the most fun was really quickly. I helped Ben write his book, and I also helped Ben write the White Sox chapter. I was the minor league guy there, but he also allowed me graciously to write a couple of the major league guys for the White Sox, and I also wrote some of the Cleveland Indians minor leaguers. My favorite comment to write was the Trey Mikulcheski comment, where I just basically wrote about his ass and used a pretty one of my favorite euphemisms for how the hips set up the ass in there. So that was my favorite. One of the ones that I thought was the most sentimental was the one about Paul Konerko and just kind of reflecting on his career and where it's gone since the World Series. And I think the one that was probably the most informative was the Avisail Garcia one. So yeah, those are my favorites. Brett, why don't you list about 3 or 10 of your favorite ones?
Yeah, I like the rest of us, I contributed to Ben's book as well. I also contributed to the 101, and I did the vast majority of the comments in the Nationals and Rangers chapters. There were a lot of favorites. My personal favorite is probably the Lucas Giolito one. Although the one that I think turned out the best in the end was probably the Anthony Rendon comment. To be perfectly honest for our readers, that comment was about a B+ when I turned it into to Sam and Jason, and as they do for literally all of us, it turned into an A+ for the book. So yeah, the annual is probably my favorite thing to be involved in the entire year at Baseball Prospectus. It's extraordinarily fun to work on and to get in the mail. I got my copy in the mail today, and my daughter was wondering why I was ignoring her for a half hour once I got home. So it's something I'm very proud to be a part of. And Ben, thank you for letting me contribute to your book.
Yeah, no problem, guys. I also contributed to my book. I wrote all of the Red Sox chapter and then the Major League half of the White Sox chapter. Favorite comments? I don't know. I didn't think this was my best comment at the time, but my Moises Sierra lineout, which is now in the Kansas City Royals section, has received some praise, which apparently varies in level of sincerity because some people walk around telling everyone they have the best comment in the book. But I'm not bitter. It's totally cool, Sam. Thanks. Some of my other favorite comments are, I've actually now had an editor apologize for me in print, that one of my Matt Barnes references was so awful that I think it was Woj, it seems like Woj, apologized for me in print. I worked the shruggy face emoji into my Clay Buchholz comment, so
the shruggy that was, face. That's an awesome.
That's good. I'm pretty good.
Pretty happy about that. So that's actually physically printed in this book. And then other than that, I really liked my Daniel Webb comment in the White Sox chapter. And my Tyler Flowers comment was awesome.
Content.
Wow.
Little what? I just like mowed myself.
You did.
Yeah, so that's basically what I have. Real quick, did any of you have a joke that was edited out that you're particularly salty about? Brett, we'll go with you first. Did you get edited at a time that you think was inappropriate?
No, although I haven't looked through every single one of the edited version of my comments. I'm still shocked that they...
What, do you have a family or a life?
I'm still shocked that they left the first three sentences of my Lucas Giglio comment in there. I'm pleased, but pleasantly surprised.
Mal?
No, my slider comments were toned down in the Rodon comment, but that's about it, really.
Craig?
Yeah, I, like Brett, haven't compared all of mine. And for the most part, I wanted to echo what Brett said about Jason and Sam. I mean, Ben, you picked two really good editors for this book. I agree that not only is this like one of the things I'm most proud of, like, and happy to contribute to throughout the year, but like the amount of work they do is kind of staggering, and like you can see the care in it. Like, it's obviously, it's hard to tell if you're not involved in the process, but to go through and look at the attention that they give every comment and then realize how many comments there are, it is mind-blowing to me. And I just, honestly, like Brett said, so many comments I turned in that I thought were like okay, and they read so much better once you see the final version. So yeah. Good job by Ben.
Yeah, they're great. Whatever. I have a bone to pick. I had a Keith Couch line out that I referred. Like, it's my goddamn book. You think they'd let my jokes stay? I referred
to. We can address this if we ever do a crossover episode with the Effectively.
Oh, they're gonna hear about it from me. Don't worry. I referred to Keith Couch homers as couch potatoes. Couch potatoes, and they took that out. Why even buy the goddamn book if you're gonna censor me?
Especially after they left the whole flowers comment in. There's nothing. The flowers comment is not any better than couch potatoes.
Like, also, flowers, the flowers comment is not
any better than anything.
Yeah, the flowers comment is just nonsensical, but in a good way.
I love the flowers comment.
So I worked. I did work the Wolverine pun into this, but next year we have to all work Enya puns into my book next year.
Deal.
Agreed.
Welcome back to episode 41 of Tino. As always, we'll send you out with a little housekeeping. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Every rating and every review helps us tremendously, unless you leave bad ones, you poopheads. And we love reading your comments, unless you leave bad ones. Also, check out our sweet new Facebook page. It is totally unique. It pushes our brand and our content, and it is totally unlike any other Facebook page you have ever seen. Big news on BP, because this upcoming week we will be publishing the much-anticipated Top 101 Prospects list, so keep your eyes out for that. Please follow this podcast on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett at Dynasty Guru on Twitter. You can find Mauricio at mrubio52. You can find Craig at CD, that's CD as in see you tomorrow, dude, Goldstein. And you can find me at Ben Carsley. Thank you for listening. Please buy my book and have a good night.
There's going to be a Snapchat story. Yeah.
I'm assuming it's going to just be a weekend haze, but yeah.
Ben, I've been funny.
she and Tamara up to?
They have a show. They have a reality TV show.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
I just looked them up, though. I still would.
Yeah. Well, they were in our age group, man. They're not that old.
Yeah, we're kind of old now.
Yeah.
Well, you're old. You're kind of old.
I'm definitely kind of old. You're still mid-20s. You're just disappointing right now. Soon you'll be disappointing and old.
But to be fair, I've been disappointing and young, so it's I don't know if the transition is going to be terribly difficult for me.
It's an easy transition. So
one more question before we get back to the real thing. Have you anyone else seen The Slap?
Oh, the commercial?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
That can't be real.
No,
that
there's no way.
It's ridiculous. Dude, they put it on during the Super Bowl.
I want to start a podcast about The Slap with us. I want us to be the only four people who watch all three of The Slap's episodes before it's canceled, and I want to blog about it for a very long time.
Legitimately, if you want to do this, I am totally in on it.
I think we should do it. I think we should do it.
I think we should. I think okay. we should, yeah.
Slap Show Prospectus.
No, I'm serious. I'll make a logo and everything.
That kid's a dick, though. I'm just saying, kid fucking swinging. I mean, can't swing a baseball bat like that. Kid looked like fucking Javier Baez just warping that thing around. Had no idea what he was going to hit, if he was going to hit anything.
You just swinging and hoping.